Hey everybody, so as some of you may know, Paul is currently a candidate for the Down Under Fan Fund. As the name suggests, it is a funding opportunity to help send a fan from elsewhere to Australia. In this case, it's to send a US fan to Australia for Continuum, a major science fiction convention in, well, obviously, the land down under. Paul is obviously currently trying to raise funds. I'm not sure exactly how much he has left to go, but he does have until March 10th to raise the funds necessary to send him over there. And if you'd like to help him do that, and we recommend that you do because Paul is adorable, you can easily go to our show notes for episode 315, that's this episode, and you can find both the link to Paul's post explaining the process and to Duff itself, to the page where you will go to donate. Donations are made through PayPal. I should also note that it is very likely Paul will be conducting all kinds of weird interviews and discussions and all kinds of things while he's there. I've also personally received a promise, although he will deny this publicly, that he will get pictures of every Australian snake. And so those are, I think, the perfectly good reasons why you should definitely donate. Or you should donate because Paul is actually just a really fantastic person. He is what I like to call an Uber fan. So if you'd like to donate, please do so. Minimum donations are $5, but you can donate as much as you want. So if you've got $10 million lying around, give it away. All right, now to the episode.
The edge of our hope. The end of our time. We've chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we're canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanty Show.
Why the long face?
I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
I'm Trish.
And we're here today with a very special guest, Mike Martinez. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Sean. How are you? Hello, ladies.
I'm alive.
Excellent.
We're all alive for now.
And we stayed alive after this movie, which is impressive.
That is honestly, given some of the things we've watched, that isn't as impressive as you think. So we've watched some real stinkers. This one, I think, if you died, that would be actually surprising.
It wasn't horrible.
But it wasn't good.
It wasn't as bad as I expected.
It didn't age as badly as I thought it would.
So fun fact. My internet cut out earlier today. I wasn't sure when the internet was going to come back, so I told Jen, and Jen decided I'll watch the movie just in case I need to come and do this episode last minute. She finished about 15 minutes before we started recording and said to me, you know, it's not as bad as I thought it was, which I think is very interesting, because I also agreed. It's not as bad as I remember it being, but it's also not good.
Yeah, it's just not good.
Did we tell them what movie we're watching, first of all?
No, they have no idea what we're talking about.
We can keep talking when they can guess at the end.
Yeah, let's put off the title as long as possible.
Well, if they've seen the episode title when they download it on their feed.
Oh, fine.
Unless you title it as Mystery Torture Cinema.
That would be fun. So we're talking about the 2005 version of Fantastic Four. This is, of course, very distinct from the Roger Corman 1990s version, which we have also covered on this show. Just in case you were confusing the two, one of them is a B-movie that is actually kind of enjoyable, and one of them is a movie people would like to forget, but they can't. So before we get into diving into that stuff, we need to talk about what we're all drinking. So we're going to start with you, Mike. What are you drinking, sir?
I am drinking a Anderson Valley Winter Solstice Seasonal Ale.
That sounds really nice.
So I like me some fancy beer, and Anderson Valley always does really good beer. And so this is their winter ale, and it's very nice and drinkable, and got a little hint of that, like, you know, pumpkin pie type spice in there and whatever. And it snowed yesterday and sleeted today, so I'm really okay with it.
Perfect. All right. What about you, Julia?
I am drinking hot water with lemon and ginger in it because I am trying to make sure I don't get sick.
That is, I think, very fair. So what about you, Trish?
Julia's idea sounds really good, and I wish I was doing it, but I'm just drinking pure H2O. I wasn't excited enough about this movie to try to think of anything theme-related to it.
Pure hydro.
Pure hydro.
Yep.
Good job, Trish. Cool. So I am drinking what remains of my Evan Williams Kentucky Cider. There isn't a lot. So then later on, I will be drinking some of my Pimm's Blackberry and Elderflower, which is also fantastic. And that's basically what I'll be drinking today. It's going to be wonderful.
And this Kentucky Cider is a hard cider?
It's like a harder than hard cider.
Oh, so you're getting faced right now, is what you're saying.
There's about two shots in here. I think it's about 15 to 20% alcohol per.
So like a 40 proof. It's like a schnapsy type thing or something. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, it's kind of like that level. So it's. I think it's designed to sort of, you mix it with an actual cider and it makes it even more super cidery. It's sort of cider squared. So that's what we're all drinking. So we're here to talk about this movie, which means Julia has volunteered herself to be tribute, to tell us what this movie is about. So Julia, what is Fantastic Four about?
Well, that's one of the problems with it. It's not about very much. So this movie is a reboot. Well, yes, I guess, because the first one didn't actually get into theaters. So question about whether it's actually a reboot of the Fantastic Four franchise made by studios so they don't lose the rights to the characters and that they would then go back to the Marvel vault. And I guess Disney would control them and maybe make a better movie because we've seen Disney doing good things with Star Wars. But instead, we get a continuous string of bad Fantastic Four movies. And this is the one from 2005, which does the original origin story. The group of four goes into space to investigate some sort of cosmic cloud along with Dr. Victor Von Doom. And surprisingly, Victor Von Doom turns into a supervillain and everybody else gets superpowers. Sue Storm becomes invisible and creates force fields. Richard Reed is Mr. Fantastic, who stretches himself in incredibly terrifying CGI ways. Ben Grimm becomes the Thing, and he is made of rock, and he says, it's clobbering time. And then there's a Johnny Storm, who becomes the Living Torch and puts things on fire and is hilariously a pre-Captain America Chris Evans, which is fascinating because he's basically the opposite of everything Captain America stands for.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, it shows that Chris Evans has range, and so that's nice.
But this movie, like, takes forever to get to the point where they even get superpowers. I think it was at least 45 minutes before they actually displayed any superpowers. And then there's just not much that actually happens. But eventually, Victor Von Doom tells Ben Grimm that he can turn him back into his normal self, because everybody else gets to be normal human-looking but have superpowers, except for Ben Grimm, who's like, I am constantly made of rock, and my fiancé has left me, and everything is horrible. And Victor Von Doom is like, I can change you back. So he does, and then knocks him out and becomes superpowered Victor Von Doom and Dr. Doom. And then he's like, I'm going to ruin everything. And the Fantastic Four are like, no, we will not allow it. And then they win. That's the end.
And the Thing, by the way, actually opts to get his rock covering back.
Yeah, he becomes the Thing again. And actually, like, at first he's angry about that it's clobbering time doll that Johnny Storm shows him. But by the end, he decides to become the Thing again and actually say it's clobbering time and clobber Dr. Doom. And he gets a blind girlfriend.
But that's, like, the first plot hole in the movie. Because, of, like, if Ben Grimm can just basically go into the containment chamber and turn his Thing on and off, literally, then why stay orange and Rocky all the time? So that right there was just you could just drive a truck through that plot hole.
Well, it becomes a plot hole because in the second movie they don't ever come back to it, like, at all. Like, it makes sense if that's where they end with, right? Like, we could do this, but then we're not going to actually talk about the ramifications. But the second film just decides to drop it. Yeah, we have this technology, we could not make you that anymore, but we won't look into it anymore. It's okay. You just stay like a rock.
Right. We just reinforced all the elevators in the Baxter building so they could carry him. That's what we did.
Like, they could make him like the Hulk, right? Like, where he, not loss of control Hulk, but where he could, like, turn it on and off like Johnny. We're like, ha ha, clobbering time, ka-cha!
Right, totally. You know, give him like a, you know, obviously, you know, shrink it down. It was 2005 then. By now, it's probably in a utility belt. But no, he's Rocky and everything else. And he decided to, because he's got a blind girlfriend now who sees him for who he is inside, as opposed to the crustacean exterior.
Who tells him that being different isn't always bad.
True, and that message gets carried on to the next one, except because he stays in rock form, we get to have more conversations of Johnny wondering how his penis works.
No.
And I'm not even kidding. There's literal jokes about it.
No, I believe you. Johnny would ask that. I also forgot there's a very important long sequence where Johnny randomly leaves the rehabilitation center with a hot nurse to go helicopter skiing.
Because why not?
Because one of the producers saw it on, like, ESPN and thought extreme skiing belonged.
I wonder if, like, one of the producers saw it on ESPN and was like, I'd like to go helicopter skiing and pay for it with Hollywood monies.
Yeah, sure. That could have been it, too. Perfect.
That sounds strangely credible. Well, not actually strangely.
Yeah, so I feel like we're going to have a lot to say about this movie.
I don't know how much we're really going to have to say. We've already said most of it.
There's much more to discuss, I think. So we're going to dive into our likes then. We're going to start with the nice things, and then eventually this podcast will degrade into drunken anger about the movie. And I think Mike and I will be the ones just yelling incoherent words about various aspects of the Fantastic Four.
I don't even need to be drunk.
Fair enough. But on that note, we're going to start with you, Mike. What is your first and only like?
So, I actually like the casting. I actually think that the cast could have done a good job had the script been remotely interesting and or actually about the Fantastic Four. So, I am a big fan of Ian Griffith, and I'm pronouncing his name wrong because it's Welsh and it has lots of consonants in it, but he was fantastic in the Horatio Hornblower series, which obviously was near dear to me, and I thought he was very credible as a sort of a doofus genius. I think Chris Evans nailed being a prick pretty well, surprisingly, because, you know, he is Captain America, and, like, you know, everybody wants him to go to the White House and punch Donald Trump now, and we would pay money for that. So the fact that he can, in 2005, play a very credible ass, more power to him. Michael Chiklis, you know what? He's a great actor, and he was, you know, I'm sure he fired his agent after this one. And Jessica Alba, okay, fine, you know, they made her blonde and probably the weakest one on the cast, but given the crap that they made her wade through, including, you know, taking off her underwear several times over, I think that given a better script, she could have done a fantastic job. So my like is that if you were going to cast the Fantastic Four, these were great choices. It's just they're just in the wrong Fantastic Four movie.
I agree with you.
Yay.
Is that it? Or?
That's what I liked. I liked the casting. Then they got on set, and then they were given their scripts, and it all went downhill.
It all went downhill. Yeah. Of the four main cast members, I think Chris Evans and Chiklis are the best cast, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
I would also argue for Ian.
Yeah. I mean, he does pretty good, but I think it's really hard to tell with him because he is supposed to be this sort of stupid smart person, and it's hard to tell how much of that is script and how much of that is like, what the hell am I doing?
Right. Well, he was playing someone with approximately zero emotional quotient, and so he had to be a little withdrawn. I thought he was fine in that.
He can act. If you check out A&E's old Horatio Hornblower series, he was Hornblower in that, and he was fantastic. Knocked it out of the park. Boy can act. It was just the film.
He's also in King Arthur, by the way. Not a good movie.
Not a good movie.
We've also covered that, but he does actually pretty good in that.
He was Lancelot, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was Lancelot. And I thought his performance in there was really quite good. So I could see that. Yeah, I agree. Alba seems like the weakest choice, and I don't know how much of that again goes down to script, because she gets just like the worst scenes, which I'm sure Julia will bring up later. Are you going to talk about those scenes, Julia?
Oh, am I going to talk about those scenes?
Okay. So I will save that. I will save that for later, because she gets what amounts to just the worst. Half the time, her scenes aren't dialogue. It's just
her taking off her clothes, but we'll talk about that later.
Right, basically the making the girl invisible.
In Jessica Alba's defense, I did like her in Dark Angel, the TV show way back in the early 2000s. You know, that wasn't a part with a lot of emotional range either, but that's down to apparently the parts she's able to get. I don't know how she would do in a really good dramatic role, but I thought she was just fine for the level that was demanded of her in this movie.
Such a glowing recommendation right there. She was fine for the level demanded of her in this film.
Well, I'm not saying I don't know how she would do dismissively. I really don't know, you know, maybe she's great.
I think she's fine. I think she can be a great actress. I don't think any of them really, you know, mailed it in. I just think that they're just given this steaming pile of crap, and they're like, okay, you know, we got to do a superhero movie.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Mike, that this movie actually did have really reasonable casting, and And not terrible production values. It was just bad. I mean, I don't think it's the actor's fault. It was just bad.
I mean, it makes sense why Michael Chiklis would be in this, and given the role that he's presented, because he's on The Shield. Like, he's right smack in the middle of the run of The Shield when this film comes out. So he's, like, at the height of his star. He's playing an angry cop dude who does various immoral acts. And it sort of makes sense, like, okay, let's channel that grumpy, wide-shouldered anger into a giant rock monster. Makes some degree of sense.
Yeah, and his plotline is the most interesting of anything that's happening in this movie. It's just that not even that is very good.
Well, yeah, because all of their plotlines are, we have sciencey McSciencey person, all we know is that he's terrible at business and does science, and had a thing with Sue Storm. Sue Storm, we know, I guess, that she does science stuff. And has a thing with two other dudes. Then Johnny Storm, I guess his only plot is, I'm a dick and I like to get laid and drive in fast cars.
Yeah, Johnny Storm apparently meant to be in Ghost Rider, but instead he was in the Fantastic Four.
They set the wrong part of him on fire.
You should have had a flaming skull.
Well, all right. Well, okay, let's dive down to Julia. So what about you, Julia? First, like.
Okay, so... This movie basically had 3 points that made me somewhat amused or happy in certain ways. One of them was when Johnny Storm realizes that he can make Jiffy Pop using his hand. Which I watched this movie with friends. That was also my friend Tori's favorite part. So hi, Tori, if you're listening, shout out to the Jiffy Pop.
That made me smile, too.
That is a good touch, yeah.
The second one was, during the helicopter skiing incident, it was basically a long setup to make Chris Evans run around in, like, the pink puffer jacket that the nurse was wearing and nothing else, which he, like, fastens around his groin. And we were watching this and just sort of like, this is ridiculous and terrible, but also kind of funny, but also terrible. And Tori was like, yeah, I wonder if this is why he has no nudity clauses in all of his contracts now, because he won't even take off his shirt in films anymore. And I was like, maybe yes. Maybe you just have to be in one Fantastic Four movie where it's all about weird objectification before you say, I'm not going to do that anymore. But... yes, that was, like, bizarre and over the top, and at least a sign that they were going both ways, because they sure did a lot of women taking off their clothes. And the third thing that made me happy was that there was a Dalmatian in the fire truck who did not die, and was worried for that Dalmatian. But eventually, even though the fire truck was dangling off a bridge and we lost some firefighters, the dog stayed alive.
Dog made it!
The dog made it. Saved by Ben Grimm, of course.
Well, saved by Ben Grimm, who also caused the entire problem.
Well, sorta.
Yes.
No, it was really on him.
He was trying to stop that guy from killing himself, and then the guy jumped down, so he had to save him.
And in the process, he caused a massive car accident and killed some other people, so...
You know how bad traffic is on the Brooklyn Bridge as is. It really, I mean, he should be shot.
Well, look, okay, if the people on that bridge were observing the traffic signs telling them how fast they're supposed to drive, maybe it wouldn't be a problem, because that truck would have had enough time to stop if it'd seen the person on the road. But oh no, he wanted to go 75 across the bridge, and Ben Grimm had no choice. He had to get down there and save that man. What? Lawyered.
Son, please.
I mean, and this is, again, stretching plausibility, because I don't think anyone could ever go 75 on the Brooklyn Bridge.
And the thing of it is, if you could, of course they would go 75 on the Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, they'll go as fast as humanly possible. This is New York. Come on. Seriously, I have seen people go 55, like, in The Village, where the streets are about the size of a Yugo. I mean, come on, man.
That's pretty crazy.
Oh, it's nothing. I actually live in Jersey, where only the strong survive. It gets even worse.
Jersey, where everyone's catchphrase is, it's clobbering time.
No. It's usually just, that's too many words. You basically just say F you, and that's...
Okay, fair enough. Well, all right. So you're happy about the Dalmatian not dying.
Yeah. So what about you, Trish?
Well, my major like, I suppose, is that this movie is not as bad as I expected. Now, I know that's not a ringing endorsement, but I don't mean to give a ringing endorsement for this movie. I kind of resent spending $2.99 to watch it, and I hope that people listening to our teardown of this movie give some money to the Patreon just to make me feel better about wasting my money.
Shameless self-promotion.
Other than that, there were a few things that I liked. This movie gave a paycheck to Chris Evans, so if he had been thinking about quitting acting before, he stayed on and moved on to better things. I looked at IMDb and didn't recognize anything he had been in before this, and eventually, of course, he did become Captain America, and I love him to pieces in that role. Other little things I liked. Leonard, the flunky of Victor Von Doom, reminded me a little bit of the flunky in North by Northwest, and that guy, his character, was named Leonard also. So I don't know if that was deliberate or if scriptwriters just think that Leonard sounds like the name of an assistant. Apologies to any Leonards who may be listening to this podcast. And, oh yes, one other thing I liked was that they really did make Johnny Storm a jerk. And the early comics, he really was a jerk. They could have pulled back and just made him kind of reckless or arrogant or whatever, but they went full on and made him a little cruel, like when he labeled Ben Grimm, his acquaintance at least, and some kind of friend, a thing. And that was really nasty. And then he said later that Ben had started it when there was an almost fight. Oh, that reminds me. That's one other thing that I liked, that they didn't have a full-on fight between Ben and Johnny, and I had thought they were leading up to that. So that's a series of faint praise and small likes for me for this movie, and that's what I've got.
So what's interesting is that they don't have a big full-out fight between Johnny and the Thing, but they do have a very physical fight between the Thing and Mr. Fantastic.
Well, they don't trade punches.
Fight of a sort. They don't really do punches, but it's clearly a very physical altercation. Like, Ben tries to throw him off, and like, it's very physical, but it goes horribly wrong. But yeah, because I think we're supposed to expect that Johnny and Ben are just gonna get in a fist fight. And let's be real, the Thing wins that fight.
Oh yeah.
In a heartbeat.
Yeah, because Johnny is just he's just all mouth, right? He can do fire and all that stupid stuff, but the Thing is a rock. Like, he punches Johnny in the face, he doesn't have a jaw anymore.
Pretty much.
I think that's how it works, because I don't think he could melt him.
Well, they were talking about Johnny, like, having, like, it's possible, but I think it would have to be prolonged exposure.
I mean, I suppose in order to melt him in enough time, he'd have to literally light the Earth's atmosphere on fire, which we learn is a problem for Johnny, who almost turns himself on so hot, that's an odd phrasing, to the point where he's almost the heat of the sun.
Which is another point of stretching plausibility. If you are the heat of the sun and you are on Earth, the Earth no longer exists because the heat of the sun on Earth kills Earth.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how it works.
Well, he's a very small point source, so I think it would take time for him to destroy the Earth.
Certainly that building is no longer there.
Yeah, like 10 blocks of Midtown is gone. I mean, come on.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I like how that's the concern.
You know, that's part of the Fantastic Four, though. I mean, out of all of the Marvel heroes that they've come up with, past, present, the Fantastic Four are, perhaps, in terms of their superpowers, the most absurd.
They're definitely absurd.
Think about it. I mean, the Human Torch, he lights himself on fire, and he can fly. The two of which are not actually go together super well. Don't know how that works. And, you know, you see, like, the Human Torch, he's on fire, he's walking around, whatever, and you're like, okay, seriously, you would be melting cars, you would be melting the pavement, everything around you would be melting. Reed Richards has not actually caught on fire yet, why not? So, I mean, that doesn't make sense. I mean, the stretchiness is kind of neat, but also weird, and there's a lot of body ick that goes with that.
Yeah, Johnny even flat out says that moment when puts his arm underneath the door, says, that's just gross. And yeah, it is. It is kind of gross.
It is.
It's super gross.
And then you have the living rock, and then actually Sue Storm has probably the most interesting and not nonsensical skill set.
Well, the thing about the living torch is that if he can control what temperature he is, he wouldn't necessarily be melting everything because, I mean, you can have things on fire that aren't hot enough to kill everything.
Yeah, true, I guess.
It's like you can be served a flaming salad, you know, but it doesn't melt the plate.
I suppose, if he has that kind of fine control.
Well, aren't flames supposed to change colors depending on heat? Like, I don't know my physics and stuff, but...
I like that we're actually trying to make this work with science. It is, in fact, the Fantastic Four.
Like, so shouldn't he be changing, like, different colors? Like, oh, yeah, he's blue now because he's got so hot.
No, I think blue is the cooler flame.
Is blue the cooler flame? Okay, so what color does he become when he goes the color of the sun? Just yellow? Because he stays orange-ish for the most part.
White would be the hottest flame, I would think.
Whitest. Okay, so he turns white. So shouldn't he blind people?
He should definitely blind people.
Don't look directly at Johnny Storm.
I mean, aside from blinding people, when he gets to the heat of the sun, he should, like, that building should be gone. All of the Fantastic Four should be gone. Dr. Doom is no longer a problem because he's dead.
Right. There's a hole in Manhattan.
Yep, we have other problems.
So what we're getting at here is technically Johnny is the most dangerous of the Fantastic Four, not because necessarily his powers are the most dangerous, which clearly they are, but because unlike Ben Grimm, who has a sense of morality, Johnny, his personality could make him super dangerous. So what this comes down to is maybe on some level, the Fantastic Four should have been trying to stop Johnny because he's going to burn New York to the ground.
I mean, I think they should have been trying to stop all of them. They all have the potential to ruin everything.
Well, okay, fair. That's fair.
So, Sean, what's your like?
Oh, my like. Oh, boy. What do I like about this movie? You know, there's not a lot to like about this movie, because it's not very good. I think probably the thing that I liked the most about it, even though it's done super poorly and makes no sense and there's no real conversation, it happens super quickly, is I actually really do like the relationship that Ben Grimm has with Alicia. Some of that comes from having seen the next movie and seeing that it actually gets developed a little bit more, but I think I liked it mostly because it didn't try to make too much of a big deal about the fact that she's blind. Like, we have the one scene, and that's kind of it. There isn't much conversation beyond that, and it just sort of like, oh, there's a little relationship here, and like she appreciates who he is as a person, and I like that. I think that's like a really heartwarming little message. It's not developed at all. I mean, given the fact that his wife like left him the day before, and he's already macking on another girl, but
fiance, to be fair.
Yes, but you know, at the same time, I just think that's it's a nice little touch. It's not well developed, but it is something that you don't see in movies that often. And it was something that actually irritated me about the Roger Corman movie, because they just go endlessly about like, she's blind. Just so you all know, she's blind. Let's make this a big deal, rather than sort of treating that character as a person. And I felt like what little we got of Kerry Washington as Alicia Masters, there is a sense that she is a person, and like there are characters around her that are like her friends, and like she's part of this little universe. And yeah, so that's kind of what I would say. Otherwise, I just really like Ben Grimm. I think Michael Chiklis as Ben Grimm is just, I think he's a great choice, and it's unfortunate these movies were not good enough, because I think he'd be just a really great addition to the Marvel Cinematic Universe just as the Thing, because I think he does a great job. I think he's really good at it.
Let me ask you guys this, because in watching this, and I've seen The Silver Surfer, and I watched that even starkly more horrible, worse Fantastic Four that they made, was that 2 years ago?
Yes, 2 years ago.
That makes this one look like an Oscar contender. I mean,
wow.
That Thing was just god awful. Can you make a good Fantastic Four movie? How does that even look? I don't, because again, it goes back to them being so different and so weird and sort of not really fitting in a lot of continuity. How do you do that? I don't even know if you can.
So I was thinking about this a lot while I was watching this one, because it was just not very good. And I think that you could make a better version of this movie. This movie, it wasn't the worst movie we've ever seen for torture cinema, but it was bad. And a lot of what was bad was that, like, it didn't have the snappy dialogue that we expect from, say, the Avengers, right? So, like, you watch The Avengers and you got a bunch of zingers that make you laugh. And this had a bunch of really bad tries at witty banter that just fell flat. I don't think anybody watching it with me laughed once. You know, you could tighten up the dialogue. It's never going to be plausible. But you could do something that was visually interesting to look at and with snappy dialogue and quick pacing, which this also didn't really have. Like, the thing about this just taking forever to get anywhere, it was kind of like, meh. You know, the 1994, the Roger Corman one, like, or 92, whenever it was that came out and wasn't released in theaters, like, at least it kept moving. They got their powers in the first 15 minutes, and then, like, plot happened.
So we're supposed to be doing likes. Are we done with likes now? Is that it?
But I mean, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's possible. I think it's possible that you could make a better Fantastic Four movie than this one. Clearly that didn't happen in 2015, but It is theoretically, I think, possible.
I think one of the more interesting things about the comics is that they dealt with things early on that a lot of other comics did not. You had a family unit, well, a brother and sister, and a marriage not too long. I don't remember exactly how long after that. But, you know, a lot of the other team comics just have people thrown together pretty randomly. And this one had some things with family dynamics and relationships that a lot of the comics about loners just didn't address. And if you could do some of that in a movie, I think without bogging it down too much, or even with making it part of the plot, here you had some arguments, but it felt like walking through the motions. You know, we're gonna have, you know, here's a woman who's torn between two lovers or wannabes or whatever they were, and it could have been better.
She didn't seem very torn. She seemed pretty clear, like, which one she wanted from the beginning. And she's like, oh, you're just kind of being stupid, though. But I want you to fight for me. And then, like, she had a brother, but they didn't really, like, do much sibling-y stuff. But I will say, we watched the honest trailers for the different Fantastic Four movies after we watched this, because we needed a palate cleanser. Two things to note. One was that the honest trailer for this one spent a good deal of time being like, this man whose name I don't have pronounced, which I think is actually just Ian Griffith. Like, I think that's how you pronounce it. I think the D is like a TH. Aside from that, it also had a thing where it was like, and don't even ask me if it's possible to make a good Fantastic Four movie, because that already exists and it's called The Incredibles.
That is true.
And I was like, that's kind of a fair point, although I have feminist rage around The Incredibles, but it is a better movie than the Fantastic Four. And it does have the same basic power stuff going.
Well, so I think what The Incredibles has going for it is that it's very much a comedy, and it sort of recognizes that a lot of what it's doing is like playing on and having fun with the concepts of traditional superheroes. And so I think that's why that works really well. And unfortunately, I don't think that's what Marvel ever wants to do with its stuff. And so it has to find another way.
I don't know. Like, I feel like you watch an Avengers movie or like Captain America Civil War. And like, even though there are things that are angst plots, there's a lot of laughs that carry it.
There are, but I don't feel like the entire thing is meant as sort of a giant comical joke about the whole concept of it. I think it still takes the idea not as seriously as DC, just to be clear, but more seriously than it would if it was just straight comedy. And I think that's the problem with the Fantastic Four, is that it tries to be funny and cutesy too much and doesn't do anything on the back end to make the stakes for the characters actually relevant. Like, just take Dr. Doom as our example. Dr. Doom's motivation, what is it?
Good question.
Like, it seems like he wants to make money and he wants Sue Storm, and he loses both and so he wants revenge. That's okay, but that's a shitty motivation for your main villain, right? That's just not good enough. At least the villains in like Civil War we're trying to design the system to control the populace so that we don't have any more of this dysfunction and this evil. And then it turns out it's Hydra, and it's like, oh my god, it's like infiltrated the whole system. And it's this whole big to-do that then gets toppled. Doom just gets toppled because he's a jealous boyfriend who lost money. Like, that's not interesting.
I feel like in this particular thing, it suffers a bit from the bam, pow, comic books are for kids. Sort of like, and also kids don't really care if anything holds up kind of stuff, because there was a lot that was very, very just sort of surface level without any depth to it stuff going on. And I think, yeah, kids don't care why a supervillain is a supervillain. We'll just make him a villain. And kids don't care if there's any romantic tension that actually makes sense. We'll just say something, but it doesn't matter. They only care that she's going to turn invisible and maybe show up in her bra.
I was trying to decide whether Victor Von Doom was always evil in a corporate screw-the-little-people way, or did the cosmic rays and gaining powers tip him over some kind of balance and drive him mad?
He seemed pretty, like, bad to begin with, and then the cosmic rays just made him, like, made all of his badness come to the surface.
Because it seemed like before, you know, he's an unpowered, super hyper-capitalist kind of guy who's just going in trying to suck as much money out of great ideas as possible. He's a venture capitalist. That's what he does. And so that makes him kind of a dick. And so be it. But then I guess, yeah, exactly what you say, Julia. He gets the cosmic rays. He finds out he has powers. And then he's like, I'm jealous, so I destroy people.
Right. I mean, this is the guy who basically locked everybody out of the space station anyway to try to save himself from the cosmic rays. So not nice to start.
Yeah. Well, and all of the Fantastic Four, all their powers reflect their personalities. So I think the space cloud, which fundamentally alters their DNA, alters their DNA to bring out whatever parts of their personality are the strongest. So you get Johnny Storm, who's a hothead, and he literally becomes hot and volatile. And you have Sue Storm, who often feels invisible, who literally becomes invisible, but also wants to protect everybody, so then makes force fields. You have the Thing, Ben Grimm, who becomes literally someone who's so angry that he is like stone and impassable, right? But very strong. And this is like something that he has to learn to control. And then you have Richard Reed, who is just like trying to stretch himself as thin as possible to do all the science that he wants to do. And then he literally just becomes the stretchy dude. So then like you have petty evil capitalist dude who becomes super actually evil Dr. Doom.
Yeah, and I think you solve all of those problems by taking away that super surface level hyper archetype type narrative, and you actually deal more with what the stakes are for the characters, and you make those more complicated and more interesting, with then taking those elements that are silly and having fun with them. Like The Flash. The Flash is a great example of this, the TV show, right? I mean, the very concept of The Flash is ridiculous. He runs so fast he can go back in time. That's insane, right? That makes no sense. Almost all of The Flash's solutions to problems are, I just have to run faster, right? If I run faster, I'll solve the problem, right? That's ridiculous. But they make fun of it, right? And they make the underneath of that about his complicated relationship with the people in his life, and in some cases, the villains, right? The complicated relationship of what their motivations are and all these kinds of things. So there's a lot there. Obviously, it's a TV show, so we can spend more time developing these ideas. But I think you have to have that instead of these overly simplified, I'm just jealous because some other dude's going to steal the girl who wasn't actually my girl. She tells us flat out they were never a thing. And there's no indication that they're actually dating at any point. He just wants to propose to her like she's a trophy. It's bizarre. Like, what inclination did we ever get that there was a romance between them?
He actually said, think of it, if it makes it easier for you, think of it as a promotion.
Yeah, right?
Right, and which, because that's really going to get any woman's heart, or any man's for that matter. Like, you know, will you accept my promotion to junior partner? No. No, actually, I won't. And take that ring, and here's exactly where you put it.
I don't know, Mike. If you came to me and you offered that, I might say yes.
You know, I look good on paper, but no. My balance sheet ain't all that great. I'm a writer, dude.
I know. You make like $3.
So we have like talked extensively about like randomly how to make this movie better, but we haven't actually gone into our dislikes, which I feel like we should do now.
Yeah, we need to move on to the things that are probably going to be funnier.
So, Mike, what is your dislike?
Oh, God. Ah, man. So, can I just say the whole script? Because, you know, and maybe we're spoiled, because the other really big superhero movie to come out in 2005 was Batman Begins. And that was, you know, it wasn't quite as earth-shaking as the Dark Knight, but it was a really good step in that evolution. And then you got the Dark Knight, and then you got Iron Man and the MCU. You had some inklings from the X-Men about some, you know, better superhero movies, but I still think this is sort of like pre-Renaissance almost. So I'm watching this again, having seen all the Iron Mans and the Thors and the Avengers and the Deadpools. My God, Deadpool. All of it. And to see this, it was quaint in how bad it was. It's like, oh yeah, this is what we thought was a good superhero movie in 2005. And it had cheap shot jokes at women, and it had cheap shot jokes at, you know, the people who were in your team, and the humor fell flat, and the action was meh, and the origin story was labored because we haven't had 87 origin stories so far, and thus the need to cut them down to 5 minutes or less. And just ultimately, this script was like what people thought a superhero movie should be in 2005, which was a lot of bad jokes and a lot of action without a lot of plot to it, not a lot of character development, just it was a placeholder for stuff going on and character motivation, all the things we just mentioned. I mean, if I handed in a book to an editor with these level of problems, not only would they be like, you know, no, they'd also be like, and don't bother with the next two books in your contract because we just no. this just didn't work on so many levels. Just bad storytelling. So that's me on my soapbox.
Yeah, although I will say we did get the X-Men movies that came out in the early 2000s that were much better than this.
They were. And I think they were more a spiritual ancestor of the MCU stuff. I think this may have just been an outlier, but
yeah, I think this was. I think because we had the X-Men and then Batman Begins did come out in the same year as this, and like I would say the first couple of X-Men movies and Batman Begins were all miles ahead of this one.
Miles, yeah.
I think some of that comes down to that somewhat of the appearance of the legacy of both of those franchises. Like the X-Men were as ridiculous as the Fantastic Four in this movie at one point. I mean, like the first issue of the X-Men comic, I think literally the Beast and one of the other characters like meets Jean Grey and has this gosh golly wow, she's a woman who's really smart, holy moly, she's a dame, this whole like ridiculous kind of conversation that would not translate well. But the more contemporary X-Men, even by 2000, were a much more serious sort of perspective, and so in the films you get more of that than you would maybe of the kind of gosh wow. Whereas like Fantastic Four, from my understanding, is not done as well in modern incarnations as its sort of first 50 years of life. And I don't know why that is. But I think part of that just comes down to what we've already talked about. Like these characters, they haven't found a way to make them not ridiculous.
Right.
And I realize there's a Fantastic Four person who's going to just come to my house and stab me in the face.
Right. No, there are huge fans.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that like this production had a bunch of different writers that were getting signed and directors who were getting signed on and then eventually leaving the project and having differences with the studio, and it was not a case of Christopher Nolan has a vision and makes a good movie. It was a case of we got one guy, but then we're gonna make him leave, or he's gonna leave on his own because everything's gonna be terrible, and we're gonna get a different guy and another one. And that kind of doesn't do the movie any favors, I think. But I will say this movie was commercially very successful. It had a $100 million budget and made $330 million in the box office.
By today's standards, sounds really low.
Yeah, but, you know, 10 years ago?
That's three times and change what its original budget was. So that's not bad. That definitely did more than break even. And that's why we have Silver Surfer. Because this was actually a success. It was not considered a flop at all.
Right. I think, and that's why the studio hung on to it. And then you see the advent of the MCU, and you see the X-Men still, you know, I think, you know, you had X3, The Last Stand, not so great. And then they started a reboot with the First Class and the Days of Future Past, and they kind of re-got their footing on that. So Fox is like, well, we can do this. We can do the Fantastic Four, right? Let's hire the edgy guy who did these edgy things and make it edgy. And that didn't work either. So
yeah. Well, fun fact, the first of the X-Men movies in 2000, $75 million budget, roughly $300 million worldwide. So pretty much similar in the same ballpark.
Yeah. And a better movie, though.
And a better movie.
Much better movie.
Oh, absolutely.
It's kind of weird, like, when you think about it, because now it's like, if a Marvel movie makes less than $1 billion, like, that's weird. There's something wrong.
Right. No, it's easily, like, if you don't make $500 million, because each of those movies is now, like, $200 million.
Yeah. Huger budgets.
Yeah. Well, the budgets keep going up and up.
Bigly budgets. Very big budget. They're big league.
Bigly.
Budgets. Yeah. You're welcome, everybody.
I'm not going to reward that.
All right, Julia, let's go to your dislike.
Okay, so we have to talk about the way that this movie treats women, which is very badly. It's just hideous. So first of all, you got the Ben Grimm plotline where his fiance leaves him, and she's basically the worst human. Like, she talks to him on the phone, and she's like, hey, you're back? And then she sees him, and she's like, oh my god, get the fuck away from me, and freaks out. And then comes when she sees him on the news creating havoc on the Brooklyn Bridge, comes to that point to be like, I'm just going to now give you your ring back so that I can make you more upset. Like, I have no idea why he doesn't become a supervillain in this movie, because she basically could drive him to it, and she has no real character. But she exists to be in a sexy nightgown and then go away.
That really bothered me, her running out into the street in New York City with a robe that she could have closed but didn't over a nightie.
That struck me as absolutely ludicrous. I'm like, you're actually, you know, a beat cop's going to pull you over and be like, ma'am, what are you doing?
Get the hell back inside and put some clothes on. But like, okay, so her nightgown was one of the more demure things, though. Every single time we see a woman, for whatever reason, no matter what they're wearing, somehow they, like, if she's wearing a button-down shirt, she has it open way past the point where most people would have it open for office wear so that we can see cleavage. If it's like a space uniform, we have to make sure it has a zipper so she can unzip it to show cleavage. If it's like anything, she's got like the nurse is wearing a sexy nurse outfit, which, like, spoiler, real nurses don't wear that. Real nurses usually just wear like scrubs that are loose and comfortable. But no, this nurse is wearing like the mini skirt and the shirt that shows cleavage to go do her nursing things in the Fantastic Four. Because why not?
Perhaps that's what the required uniform at Victor Von Doom's medical clinic is.
Yeah, Victor Von Doom was like, everyone needs to dress like a woman.
Right, and maybe if you dress right, you'll get that promotion.
Yeah, like, but Sue Storm seems to do this on purpose. Like, she does this when she gets in her uniform, she makes sure she, like, has the cleavage showing. And she doesn't have to do that. And then, like, she seems upset about people seeing her being naked, but she also, like, half her scenes are literally her stripping, and we're supposed to be titillated by this, that she's doing this, and then half the time she loses control of her invisibility and then, like, shows up half naked because she's in, like, a bra and underwear, which it just exists to show us Jessica Alba in a lacy bra and underwear. And it's really annoying that that's, like, what all women in this are reduced to, with possibly the exception of Alicia. I don't know how much cleavage she shows, but then, like, the point of her isn't that she's a sexy woman, it's that she's blind, which it goes into another problem.
Although, just to be clear, Ben Grimm makes some little remarks at the end where he's clearly yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course.
I just wanted to make that clear. Like he admires her tookus.
Yeah, he does.
But the film doesn't do it for us, which I think is the difference.
No, the film doesn't do it as much, which is an interesting thing because you have like she doesn't need to be sexy. She just needs to be there to be into Ben Grimm and blind. But yeah, the real problem is the way women are portrayed. And then, like, can we talk about Sue Storm's plot line where, like, basically I read it that she was actually dating Victor Von Doom before he also told her to think of it as a promotion. I thought that, like, the think of it as a promotion was about marrying him, but they were already dating, was how I read that. But, like,
either way, that's a walk away line.
It doesn't really matter. It was terrible. Like, there was no reason for her to be dating him, and it was clear that she wasn't even into him. But, like, then she has the restaurant scene where she and Richard Reed are having dinner, and he's like, I'm really happy for you and Victor, which is a perfectly mature thing to say to someone that you used to date 2 years ago who's not dating you and is apparently in a happy relationship with someone else who is also your friend, right? You should be like, yeah, okay, you know what? You're not my property because we broke up and we should be moving on. And if I want to be like an actual decent person and be friends with you, I should try to be happy for you dating whoever you're dating now. That's a perfectly reasonable response. But Sue Storm's response to that is, how dare you? You won't even fight for me. And I'm like, that is not actually reasonable at all, and is an unhealthy attitude toward dating and a terrible, terrible stereotype of the sort of woman who likes to make men fight over her. So that was just why? And why does the hot nurse go out with Johnny? Like, he's terrible. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, look, none of the portrayals of women were realistic. None of the portrayals of how men reacted to women were realistic. I think if any woman acted like that, most of the people around her would be like, well, is there a problem? Are you okay? And if any man acted like that around a woman, he'd be missing teeth. So I agree with you 100%. And it is shocking how it stood out.
Yeah, because, like, basically what happens with the nurse is that, like, she is there when he wakes up from his being, like, knocked out in space. And he's like, whoa, what happened? And then starts sexually harassing her. And tells her to show up as soon as her shift is done. And the next thing you see is them off helicopter skiing. Which, by the way, how did Johnny Storm even make helicopter skiing happen?
Especially since he was unconscious for most of the day.
Right. Yeah. And, like, they apparently went helicopter skiing from Manhattan.
Oh, I thought they were still in Switzerland or wherever.
Were they in Switzerland? Whatever.
Yeah, the hotel was in the hotel. The hospital was in the woods somewhere with mountains. It was nice.
The hospital was in Switzerland. Okay, fine. But it still was just, like, ridiculous. And none of the women did well in this movie. It was just really, like, it didn't want anybody to have good characters, but the women were particularly egregiously bad, and that made me very sad. And I mean, I have to say that the 1990s one did better on that front, and I mean, it wasn't doing great.
No, it wasn't, because this has that super creepy bit where, like, older Reed shows up and is like, oh yeah, your sister's really hot now. And it's like, oh wait, the last time you met her, she was like 14. You creepy creep.
She's like a baby. Why are you doing this?
This is so disgusting. You're like a 55-year-old man. And you're like macking on an 18-year-old. What are you doing? Just to be clear, I'm not necessarily suggesting that someone who's 55 who has a consensual, loving relationship with someone who is 18 is necessarily wrong. But the added component of a 55-year-old, I don't know if he's 55, but we're just going to say he's 55. A 55-year-old man who, when he was 45, was macking on somebody who was not of consenting age, and then suddenly is back at it when she is suddenly consenting, that to me is super creepy.
Oh God, yeah, no, that's horrible.
I'm just going to say that if you're 55 and you have an 18-year-old girlfriend, you're probably pretty creepy. Okay, it's theoretically possible for there to be a consensual relationship that's okay, I guess, but, like, I've never encountered one.
I think that is fair. I just didn't want, like, on the off chance we have, like, one listener who, like, really has a very loving and consensual and wonderful relationship with someone 20 or 30 years their junior, I didn't want to, like, crap on their relationship. I wanted to make it very clear that the most creepy part about that is that he begins this relationship when this girl is, like, 14.
Yeah, he's clearly, when he is an adult, has been, like, lusting after a 14-year-old, which is super gross.
Right, which makes the age gap thing not the real issue. It's the fact that he is creepily, just getting grossed out. Oh, that part was the worst part of the Roger Corman movie. Just the worst. Because the second you knew what was going on, you were like, this is not going to be a comfortable watch from now on.
No, it was super gross.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. But yeah, but in other respects, I think it does deal with the relationships better because I think it develops them more, which is an odd thing to say about that film.
No, but I think it absolutely did. And I think it gave both Alicia and Sue more character development generally outside of relationships, too.
Yeah, I agree. Although I think that the Roger Corman film spends more time making Alicia's character too much about her blindness.
Oh, no, it does terrible things. But I'm just saying, compared to this film, it gives them both more character growth.
Okay, yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, yeah, you're right. Because we get more of them. They get to do stuff.
Yeah, I'm not saying that that film is good. Please don't think that. If you want to know how I felt about that film, there's a whole other podcast you can listen to.
I totally agree. Okay, yeah. Yeah, but I agree. Like, the number of times, like, I don't know if in 2005 when I first saw this movie, I would have had a problem with the number of times Jessica Alba just gets basically nude. Not literally nude, but basically nude. Because I don't think I would have really realized what was going on. But the more of a feminist I become, the more, like, that just really bugs me. Because it's not that I have a problem with a female character getting naked on a screen or even getting partially nude. It's just, like, how obvious those scenes are just designed as titillation and nothing else. Like, it's just like, oh, Sue Storm, she has to get naked to get to use her powers. Does she really have to do that? Like, couldn't she just use her powers and, like, her clothes just naturally go with her? No. We have to have her get naked.
And we have to call attention to the fact that her clothes don't. Like, there's multiple points where the characters point out that her clothes aren't doing that. And she needs to take her clothes off. And it's gross. It's gross and it's stupid. And I don't have a problem with women getting naked or partially naked in movies at all. If it's something that's, like, actually, you know, empowering for the woman or not something that's, like, this was both there for us to look at her and for her to be humiliated by it.
That's the biggie. That's that last one, yeah. She was there to be humiliated. Yeah, it was gratuitous. It was humiliating.
Yeah, it felt gratuitous and exploitive in a way that Johnny prancing around in his pink hip hugger did not. That was just kind of funny.
Well, and it's interesting because there's a clear, you can see the difference, right? That Sue is meant to, she's supposed to feel ashamed. Like, I'm naked in a public space.
Right.
I am ashamed of this. This is scary. Nobody look at me. But Johnny can, like, walk in. The only thing he's covering is his willy, because we're not allowed to show willies, right? But otherwise, he's just naked. And aside from the fact that he's been running around in the cold without anything on, he's not actually bothered about being naked. And we're not supposed to be bothered either. When we watch that, we're supposed to go, oh, Chris Evans. Hello, buddy.
Yeah, and the character is like, look, I can catch on fire, and that's far more important to me right now than being naked or cold. And since I can catch on fire, cold's not even an issue.
And I mean, also, it is still, that also bothers me on a gender level, because the other part of that that we're supposed to find funny is the fact that he, a very manly man who gets all the chicks, is now forced to be wearing something skimpy and pink. Which we're supposed to find funny because, of course, men shouldn't wear skimpy pink things. That's very feminine, and it's funny that we're forcing him to do something feminine. So that's disturbing to me on another level, even while it was pretty funny watching him just like, because of the size of the jacket and the way that he had to move around in it, it was pretty funny. But also it was funny because he didn't care. He obviously didn't care. I think he would have just been naked, honestly. You get the impression that, like, if you have to explain it away with story, somebody else told him, no, you have to wear this jacket.
Yeah, it's weird. It's not right.
So that's me. What about you, Trish?
Okay,
Oh, she's got a script. You heard pages move. There's like 10 pages of text she's got to read off.
Trish is now going to read her manifesto.
No, it's not that, really. It's just I wrote down things that I liked and things that bothered me. I guess my really greatest complaint about this whole movie is all the plot holes that it had. You know, being mediocre is one thing, but the plot holes that kept making me stop and try to figure out what just happened and why it happened that way. Well, I guess having to do that did distract me from the mediocre dialogue, you know, so I could let stuff go by while I was trying to make things work in my head. Why does a cosmic storm come early? That seems the least likely catastrophe. Why couldn't it have been a solar flare, or the storm was stronger than expected, but just coming early, things in space generally don't accelerate of their own accord, so that was a problem for me. How did Ben suddenly get from the medical clinic in the Alps to New York City without being seen by anybody? And how did he do that so fast? And then the others who flew after him got there almost just as fast, so that bothered me. Oh, and before we even get there, I was trying to figure out whether Sue Storm stood up Victor Von Doom, who was waiting for her with candles and everything to try and close the deal, or however he referred to getting her to marry him. You know, did they have an arranged date that she stood up on, or did he just expect her to show up because that's what she usually does or something? What else? Lots of things. Right, we already talked about Ben's girlfriend running outside in New York City onto the street in her nightie.
As you do.
The fight on the bridge where he tries to save one guy from suicide and then however many people died in traffic accidents. I guess that's not actually a plot hole, but...
The plot hole comes when everybody was like, yay, Fantastic Four, you saved somebody, I guess?
Right, they saved the firefighters, so they're all heroes.
And the dog. And the Dalmatian.
Yeah, that bit from the latest Civil War where they're having the conversation about all of the superheroes and how they don't seem to have any jurisdiction and they just do whatever they want. This is what they were talking about.
Yes.
Right. Why don't they have long interviews with public safety officials after this happens? Why don't they have government people trying to recruit them into the military? How did they get to just be fan celebrities and no consequences? That really, really bothered me.
Or the fact that they're in this building in Reed Richards' like house, his lab ninja place, and everybody knows that's where they are, and there's like they still can go outside and not get accosted by paparazzi on a constant basis. Like,
well, talk about a plot hole. How do you afford a skyscraper in Midtown if you're strapped?
No, he just owns the top floor.
Even so, you got like two levels, and you've got, it's wired for everything, and it's got killer views. That's like $50 million right there. Reed could just move to a warehouse in Jersey and fund all of his stuff forever. What the actual hell?
This is Mike's advertisement for Jersey.
I mean, I guess we can assume that every brick of it is mortgaged already, and that's how he funded his previous company that went bankrupt.
How did he get it in the first place?
So I guess that was his Series A venture capitalist funding, and he didn't get some Series B to come through. That's what happened.
Right, because he didn't go to a loft in Chelsea. He wanted top floor in Midtown. Sorry, that's a very New York thing to say.
In case Marvel is listening to this and needs an idea for what to do with their next Fantastic Four attempt in comics, you should just basically start the opening panel with Mike Martinez going, "Why is Reed Richards living in a giant $50 million skyscraper? He could just come to Jersey and live in a crappy warehouse." And then that's how it starts. Reed Richards moves to a warehouse.
You know what? I should just write it, frankly. That'd be awesome.
That would be even better choice, because if anyone knows about Jersey warehouses, it's Mike.
It's true. It's true. I drive by several of them every day on my way to work.
Yeah. He is like the number one ranker of Jersey warehouses. He runs jerseywarehousesrankers.com.
Piscataway. Just saying. You're looking? That's where you go.
He knows his stuff, guys. So, like I said, right, newjerseywarehouseranker.com. So if you go there, you can find all about his blog and all of the efforts he's done to make awareness for Jersey warehouses.
You know, now I got to go by that URL, so thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Disclaimer, none of this is true because Sean is a liar.
And also, I'm not buying the URL.
So, Trish, does that sum up all the things that you don't like?
Oh, I could go on. Yeah, the skyscraper, it actually played a fairly big part in the comics that I read in the 80s. I don't know if it still does, but the Baxter Building was a thing that actually went into space and was space-worthy in one comic. So, yeah, they had to have a skyscraper in Midtown if they were going to... Well, it was a thing in the comics, and I think they were right to have it in the movie, but they really should have explained it better, or not made such a thing about Reed being broken, or something.
Or at least make it like he owns the place outright because he's paid for it, and he's just as generally broke.
House rich, but cash poor, as we say down south.
Right.
Or, I mean, you know, he could have mortgaged it 4 or 5 or 6 times, I suppose, but it still doesn't explain how a scientist gets premium real estate like that.
This does make sense why the housing bubble burst in 2008, though.
Right?
It's all Reed Richards' fault.
Exactly.
Just hyperinflating the value of New York skyscrapers.
You put a cyclotron on top and, you know, everybody wants one.
Yeah.
Okay, so Sean, what's your dislike?
Oh boy, what to say about this movie that I don't like about this movie? So we've talked about women, and that was a big issue. I didn't like that. We've talked about character problems, talked about all kinds of things. And I think that the thing that I dislike most about this is the structure of the arc that we're being presented. Like, we've talked plot holes and we've talked issues with script, like Trish and Mike, you've covered those. But my issue is the structure of this, because the only... So usually when you have, like, one of these films, these superhero films, like, they have some kind of initial meeting with the villain, and they have an altercation, and it usually doesn't go well for the heroes, and they have to kind of regroup and figure it out. Like, Avengers does this perfectly, right? The first time they sort of face off against Loki, Loki Fs up their shit on the hovercraft, right, and kills a Coulson. It's like a big to-do, right? It becomes the breaking point for them that they realize they really have to work together in order to deal with this problem. And so later we get the actual full-on battle. And in this, we never really have that. The first real altercation with Dr. Doom is Dr. Doom showing up and putting Ben through the machine and then, like, throwing him across the room. And, like, that's basically the altercation. Like, there isn't much else to it. And then we finally get the real actual altercation later. And I think that's a serious flaw, because basically what we're building up to is this big fight at the end. But that big fight is like 8 minutes of the movie, and there's nothing really leading us there. There's not enough meat to get us to that altercation that justifies it. And it goes to all the other problems in the film. Like, Dr. Doom, like, his arc doesn't make any sense. There is no real arc here. We don't really understand his motivations. We don't know why he is such a turd. We just know he's a turd, and he's a jerk, and he's jealous, and he, like, that's it. That's not good enough for what leads us to the altercation. So, like, that's the issue I have, is, like, so much of this film is all of this build-up, but it's building up to what really should have been the first fight between them, and then later they'd have their actual legit fight where they actually defeat him. So I think it's just, it's, like, an hour and 15 minutes of just so much nothing leading up to what isn't enough. which is the opposite of what I would say about Batman vs. Superman, which is a whole lot of stuff leading up to the longest fight scene in the history of cinema. It's like an hour. I'm not even kidding, by the way. I just watched the extended cut. The fight scene, the end fight scene in Batman vs. Superman, is a full hour of the 3-hour block.
And is that the fight between Batman and Superman, or the fight between Batman and Superman and the Creature and Wonder Woman and all that other stuff?
All of it, because it's all part of the same sequence.
True, it is.
So that's almost an entire hour. That's too long, right? That's way too long. But yeah, so that's the biggest issue I have, is just structurally it doesn't follow a reasonable pattern. Even the X-Men movie that came out in 2000 does this better, because they have multiple interactions with Magneto before the final altercation. So we get a sense of what we're really dealing with. The heroes get to fail a little bit, so that when we get them to succeed at the end, there's growth and development and relief. We don't ever get that. The only relief we get at the end is they won. What did they win? I don't know. Was Dr. Doom threatening the world, or what was he actually threatening? What was any different from Dr. Doom and like just an everyday criminal? The only difference is that Dr. Doom has powers. That's it.
Doom was really problematic. Doom did not carry his weight as a villain at all. At first, it's set up really nicely. Okay, you know what? Scientist, got it. Venture capitalist, got it. Heartless bastard, sure, of course. Has his own space station, kind of awesome. So he's got all of the pieces in play, and of course he's going to be affected by the cosmic rays. And they don't really explain why the company's stock turned south. I don't know what they were, first of all, you don't publicize a hugely experimental test like this on that could go really wrong, based on a scientist who apparently can't get funding from anybody else. So, and then his stock price is going down, and then the board tosses him. Even the business side of it isn't too egregious, but then it's just sort of like he kind of becomes unhinged without really having a plan. Like, he puts a hole in the guy. Literally, it's a hole, which for a PG movie, you're like, dude, that's a hole in your chest.
It's pretty cool, actually.
It was an impressive hole. You know, and fine, you killed the guy who took your company, but it's not like you got your company back. Because apparently if you have a board, you are publicly traded, and thus you don't... What are you going to do? Kill all the other shareholders? That is a lot of holes.
Yeah, someone will figure it out eventually.
Someone will figure it out. Like,
who's killing all these people?
They all own Doom stock. Maybe they shouldn't, ticker symbol, Doom. Maybe you should have known. To get to the point where he just basically wants to kill the Fantastic Four just seems super petty. There's no logic to it. And if you can control electricity and do all kinds of really badass stuff, Doom always thought bigger. He didn't want to just kill the Fantastic Four. He wanted to take over the world. You know, this guy, jilted boyfriend, and you took my company away. I'm still filthy rich, but you took my company away. Dude, weak.
It's very confusing, because there isn't a real motivation for him.
Right, and villains are so important. You look at, Magneto, oh my gosh, and you mentioned the X-Men. Brilliant motivation, right? You look at the Joker in The Dark Knight, oh my god, a horrific motivation, but damn if he wasn't motivated. All the other villains in the MCU, I mean, some great motivations. Really added depth, and none of these guys were, except for the Joker, these guys had plans, and they didn't necessarily always see themselves as like, I'm evil because I'm evil, and I'm going to twirl my mustache a bit.
Yeah, with, of course, as you say, right, the exception of the Joker, who is chaos, literally chaos embodied. But that's what he wants to be. That's his motivation. He wants to create absolute chaos.
And he wants everybody else to be just as fucked up as he is. And that's, the way that Heath Ledger played him was no wonder Jared Leto had such a hard time in Suicide Squad, because it just, you don't go near that.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, but I mean, with Victor Von Doom, it's sort of like, at least with the Joker, we understand what his endgame is, right? He wants to create chaos, even when he creates that dilemma in The Dark Knight, right? The whole point of that is to sort of prove that people, when given a horrible choice, will choose a horrible decision. And of course, he's proven wrong in the end, but that's the whole point, right? Is he's trying to prove that people aren't as good and capable of good as we think, that when given the proper stimuli, they will do horrible evil acts to save themselves, right? This sort of chaotic horror. But Doom, like, okay, so he kills the Fantastic Four, and then what? He doesn't get his company back. Everybody knows he's nuts and he's got superpowers. And so, like, what does he get? He goes back to Latveria and, like, starts, like, a karaoke club? Like, what's the deal?
I would pay to see that.
I would. That would be nice.
Doom should be a really epic menace. He's the foe that, in the comics at least, they come back to fight again and again, and he has great schemes, long, complicated plots with wheels within wheels. And here he comes off as a less impressive version of Norman Osborn, who was a great villain in Spider-Man.
Yes.
You know, another corporate type who comes off as more menacing and more thoughtful and more interesting than Victor Von Doom.
You know, maybe that's the key to the Fantastic Four. I mean, because, you know, the family stuff, you're right, that's really good. The thing that really has fallen apart in this Fantastic Four and then the one they did in 2015 was that Doom sucked. And maybe, I mean, the reason Thor is so good is because of Loki. Let's just get that out of the way. Totally the truth. If you do a good Doom and make it worth it, make this guy, I mean, he is a scene-chewing badass who will, his drives are epic. And if you can make that a challenge to the Fantastic Four, then you can bring their characters in there, give them some very good motivation to use their super science powers, their super clobbering powers, whatever it is. Maybe that was the key that's been missing.
Well, yeah, because when we get the Silver Surfer, they basically neuter him. I mean, he only shows up again, right, by the way, just in case if you've not seen the other one, like, Doom is not dead. He, like, thaws out, I guess.
Well, that's pretty clear from the end of this one. Like, they put him on a shipping container to Latveria, and it's pretty clear that he's still alive.
Yeah, it's just one of those cheap little things, like, haha, he's not dead. Well, in Silver Surfer, they bring him back, and the military sort of hires him. Again, we don't really understand exactly the real motivation, because it makes no sense, but he tries to, like, goad the Silver Surfer into giving him power, and tries to use the Silver Surfer's power, and it ends up backfiring miserably on him. Like, he's just this... He is a shitty villain in the films. He's so poorly constructed, and he shouldn't be. He's, like, the main villain for the Fantastic Four. Like, he should be Magneto level, right? Like, even Magneto, when they neuter him in the second one by putting him in that little capsule, right? He still has these plans he's putting together to get himself out. He is still formidable. He has these amazing scenes when he's in that, like, capsule. Right, where he's talking, and like there's all of this great stuff going on, and we're understanding the machinations behind the scenes of what's going on. None of that with Dr. Doom. We don't get any of that. We just get, like, he just seems like an angry dude bro who got rejected. Like, that's what it comes down to. And that would be interesting if they really played into that and really tried to make a point about it, but they don't. And even the altercation they have, the fight they have, isn't even, like, I don't believe for a second that the Fantastic Four are going to lose.
Right.
Like, not because I know it's a Fantastic Four movie and they're going to live, but because I just don't feel, like, there's nothing that seems difficult about it. They figure it out in a matter of seconds.
Yeah, nothing in this movie feels high stakes at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this big confrontation takes out one intersection in Manhattan. Con Ed does that daily. I mean, come on.
Right. Compared to, like, X-Men, which almost literally, like, tries to create all of these mutants out of the entire New York City, right?
Yes.
Like, the scale is so pathetic.
Right. Well, and, like, the thing that you're saying about Magneto, like, Magneto, when he's imprisoned, is basically delivering to us the X-Men equivalent of Hannibal Lecter.
Yes.
Who is such a terrifying villain that even when he is imprisoned, he's still capable of doing terrible things if you let him talk at all.
Yeah.
Yes.
Although, we could go on about that, but yeah, yeah. So I guess that's just, like, I think we all basically agree, like, this is just a problem of there isn't enough in terms of stakes for the characters, good and bad.
There's just no there. This movie is just kind of boring and doesn't do much, and it doesn't feel important at all. So are we going to grade this thing?
Yeah, we do have to grade this. Yeah, we got to do that. So, Mike, we'll start with you, sir. What would you give this for a grade?
A D plus.
D plus, wow.
You know what? I mean, look, it wasn't as bad as I remembered.
Fair.
It is a passable piece of entertainment for if you can't find anything else to do or watch and have no friends.
Wow.
No, it's not bad. It's just for what it is, as a just a popcorn superhero movie distinctly aimed at teenagers as opposed to having, you know, adults really interested in motivation and whatnot. That's why it gets a D+.
Fair enough. All right. But also on top of that, you're giving it that anybody who watches this voluntarily doesn't have any friends. That's what you're saying.
I watched it for a podcast. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Julia, what about you?
I'm going to give it a D. It's not the worst thing we've seen for torture cinema. It didn't make me as angry as Transformers. It's just bad. I didn't like the way it treats women. I didn't think it had enough plot. It was, again, still not the worst thing I've ever seen. It was just not good. So, D.
D it is. All right. Trish, what about you?
I would have given it a D+ just for being not great. But Julia's arguments about the sexism and just poor treatment of women, I certainly agree with those. So that'll take it down to a D- for me. You should watch other things beside this if you possibly can, and you certainly should not pay money to watch it, ever.
Fair point. All right. Well, then for me, I would give it a D+, similar as Mike. It's not the worst thing we've ever watched. It's not a good movie. I have seen it probably more times than any grown man should see this movie.
Why? Sean, every time we watch a terrible movie for torture cinema, you're like, I've seen this a bunch of times. How does this always happen?
Not every time. Not every time. Like, that's not true.
Why have you seen this more than once?
I own the Blu-ray.
You own it on Blu-ray? Why would you buy this on Blu-ray?
I own both on Blu-ray.
Oh, dude.
Sorry. I just do.
I can't send you cider now.
I'm a completist. I want to have, like, the entire Marvel collection. Like, I want all of the films, even though I know some of them aren't good. Except Elektra. Elektra I won't put in my house. Yeah, that one's the one I draw the line there.
At least you have a line, and the completest collection thing that has some strong nerd cred. So okay.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real. I watch good movies more than I watch Fantastic Four. Like, I just want to be clear about that. It's not like I sit around and go, "Huh, I need a movie to watch. Let's put in Fantastic Four because I got nothing else to watch." No. Once in a blue moon, I'll be like.
Well, and also, if you said that at this point, you'd be admitting apparently that you have no friends.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I did that. You can have friends and watch the Fantastic Four. I feel bad. But it still only gets a D+.
It still only gets a D+. Fair. Yeah. So D+. So here we go. So I'll do the average later because I don't want to do math in my head with letters.
I mean, I guess that average is somewhere in between a D and a D+.
Yeah, it's somewhere in that vicinity. It's like a D-ish or something. I don't know. So in any case, Mike... Thank you so much for coming on and being our guest for this wonderful torture cinema episode.
Always a pleasure. I enjoyed it immensely. Even if I didn't enjoy the movie, I enjoyed trashing it.
Would you want to tell everybody a little bit about your work, anything you got coming out, where they can find you, that sort of thing?
Sure. So Majestic 12 series is what I'm doing right now. It is a Cold War paranormal spy-fi thriller. Majestic 12, MJ12 Inception is out in hardcover now, and it's coming out in paperback over the summer. And then the second in this series, MJ12 Shadows, coming out in September again. I also wrote the Daedalus trilogy, where I mashed up space opera with sailing ships, and that was a lot of fun. I do a bunch of short stories, too. I had one recently in the Endless Ages Vampire the Masquerade anthology, which made me very happy. And and I can be found at michaeljmartinez.net or on Twitter at mikemartinez72.
And don't forget, newjerseywarehouserankers.com.
Exactly. Piscataway. I'm just saying.
All right, perfect. Well, also thanks to Julia and Trish for being with me today. Thank you, guys. Or ladies. People. Thank you, people.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for putting this this podcast together.
You're welcome. Technically, I didn't do it. You should blame Jen.
Thanks to Jen for putting this podcast together.
Thank you, Jen. Hi, Jen.
Without Without you, Jen, none of us would have watched Fantastic Four from 2005.
And you know what the great part about this is? She's probably going to edit this episode, so she's going to get that message very personally. It's going to be wonderful.
Love you.
But seriously, though, Jen went above and beyond because I understand that she also watched this movie as our understudy in case one of us couldn't make it. So she has the dubious pleasure of having seen this movie and not actually been able to talk about it in a venting way.
I hope she can actually record like a postscript and just be like, you know.
She's just going to add her own rant to the end of the episode.
Just incoherent screaming at the end for like 40 seconds. Can she do that?
That would be nice, yeah.
Go for it, Jen.
Go for it, Jen. So, all right, guys. Well, if you want to let us know what you think about the movie, you can do so a number of ways. You can send us an email, skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. You can yell at us at Twitter, @SkiffyandFanty. We're also on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Just do a quick search. You can find us there. Yeah, so if you want to let us know what you thought about the movie, feel free to do so. We may even read your comment on a podcast. Keep that in mind. It's a secret that we don't tell people very often. Shh. So, all right, on that note, awkward ending. And scene. Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter @skiffyandfanty, on Facebook @The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon @patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Cronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.